Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A nuclear Iran is in the headlines again. In Thailand last week, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton raised the possibility of a U.S. defense umbrella over the Middle East, raising the notion of a new era of nuclear deterrence in the region. Was that a sign that the Obama administration is preparing for the reality of a nuclear-armed Iran? Maybe. The signals from Washington are mixed. Israel's pushing back hard. This hour on Point, can we, should we, have a plan B on Iranian nuclear weapons? Could we effectively raise a defense umbrella? You can join the conversation. Iran says it's not building a bomb, but if it's attack or umbrella, which would you choose? Why? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's go straight to the comments that got this whole latest round of comment and criticism started. Bangkok, in Thailand, last Wednesday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the U.S. would consider extending a defense umbrella over the Gulf region if Iran did not halt its nuclear program. Here she is in a televised interview with the Thai media group The Nation.
We want Iran to calculate what I think is a fair assessment, that if the United States extends a defense umbrella over the region, if we do even more to support the military capacity of those in the Gulf, it's unlikely that Iran will be any stronger or safer because they won't be able to intimidate and dominate as they apparently believe they can once they have a nuclear weapon.
That brought all kinds of immediate interpretation. The LA Times called it a sign that the Obama administration is preparing for the reality of an Iranian bomb. On Meet the Press with David Gregory on Sunday, Secretary Clinton said the talk of a nuclear umbrella, defense umbrella, as a reality, it's premature. She said the international community is trying to send a message to Iran.
If you're pursuing nuclear weapons for the purpose of intimidating, of projecting your power, we're not going to let that happen. First, we're going to do everything we can to prevent you from ever getting a nuclear weapon. But your pursuit is futile because we will never let Iran, nuclear armed, not nuclear armed, It is something that we view with great concern, and that's why we're doing everything we can to prevent that from ever happening.
All right, but let's be specific. Are you talking about a nuclear umbrella?
We are not talking in specifics, David, because, you know, that would come later, if at all. You know, my view is you hope for the best, you plan for the worst.
Hope for the best and plan for the worst. Joining me now in the studio are two big thinkers on the issue. Barry Posen is professor of political science and director of the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's author of the 2006 Century Foundation report, Nuclear Armed Iran, a difficult but not impossible policy problem. Barry Posen, welcome back to On Point.
Hello.
And former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the first Clinton administration, Graham Allison, joins us. He's professor of government, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of Nuclear Terrorism, the Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe, and the seminal 1971 book, Essence of Decision, Explaining the Cuban Missile Crisis. Graham Allison, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Barry Posen, first to you, what do you see going on in these Clinton comments? Is this evidence of Obama administration planning for Iran to have a nuclear weapon? And if it should, are we back to nuclear deterrence in the Middle East? Is that on the drawing board somewhere?
Well, I think we're in a situation where the internal consideration of options has somehow crept into the external sphere. Mm-hmm. So I think it's good that we're essentially talking through the various options that we have. And, you know, one of them is that somehow, some way, our diplomacy with Iran will succeed. The second is that the one that was on the table in past years, which is one that the Israelis keep bringing up, which is the idea of a preventive attack. Mm-hmm. And the third is the idea of containment and deterrence. And I think it's a good thing that we consider all three of these options, because the best case may not work out, and then we may find ourselves in a situation of having to choose between two tough alternatives: prevent a war and containment and deterrence. Second of all, I think the Secretary of State is making a point here that is often lost, and that is that if you want to support American and Western diplomacy vis-a-vis Iran, there's a lot of let's call them threats that can be wielded. And one threat is economic coercion. One threat is prevent a war. But containment and deterrence is a third kind of threat. I mean, the Iranians should be thinking very, very carefully about whether they want to live in the world in that that they're getting ready to create for themselves if they go nuclear. And that's a threat that, a bargaining chip that I think we have to deploy that has not so far been deployed. And I think Secretary of State was putting it on the table. I think it was a good thing to do.
Why would deterrence be scary to the Iranians?
Well, ask how you want to live. Do you want to live in a world where not just the Americans, but the entire oil-consuming world has an interest in that part of the world sufficiently strong that they're all sort of providing reassuring kinds of statements or reassuring kinds of deployments to the Arabs? Do you want to live in a world where the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is a fairly weak organization militarily and politically, becomes a much stronger organization militarily and politically? Do you want to live in a world where others have to start considering what nuclear strikes on Iran would look like in the event that Iran used or threatened a nuclear weapon? Does Iran want to live in a world where it's in a nuclear arms competition with the last superpower left on the planet? I mean, Iran is getting ready to create a very interesting world for itself. And I think, as the Secretary of State made clear, this is a world where Iran, in many respects, is not going to be more secure. Now, in one respect, there's always this argument for having nuclear weapons. And if you have nuclear weapons, somebody's probably not going to invade you. But I think the time when the Iranians had to fear invasion is probably past, partly, I think, because the Americans have had a tough enough time swallowing the morsels in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't think we have any appetite for trying to invade Iran, and I don't think anybody else does either, right? So I think this is a fear the Iranians are trying to solve with nuclear weapons. It's really not a particularly live problem for them anymore.
Graham Allison, we've heard from you for years on this region and the security situation there and on Iran. How do you interpret these latest comments from Hillary Clinton? Is this an internal conversation preparing for the reality of Iranian nuclear weapons that slipped into the public discourse? Or is it, in fact, as she clarified on Sunday, is this a way of saying to the Iranian regime, think about it. There's no point in this, because even if you get them, you'll have a lousy sort of containment around you.
I think Barry's summary is basically got the fundamental point right. I mean, if you ask the question, how in logic is it possible to respond to one nation's buildup of military power, including nuclear power, an alternative and a natural alternative is to try to say, what actions can the U.S. and its allies and friends take that would nullify or diminish the significance of an Iranian military buildup? Mm-hmm. And so in logic, the point that the Secretary of State made, namely that by building up U.S. and allied both offensive and defensive capabilities, a benefit that Iran could hope to achieve by building up its own nuclear, or its own military forces, including nuclear forces, would be significantly diminished. So, for example, if a missile defense shield works, or even works to some extent, and the U.S. were to deploy a missile defense shield in the region, the significance of an Iranian nuclear bomb with a missile would be diminished. Mm. Similarly, if the U.S., as Barry mentioned, if the consequence of Iran's proceeding with its nuclear ambitions is to mobilize an alliance in the region against Iran, I mean, one of the worst things the Soviets did was whenever the alliance against it was about to fall apart, would do something stupid like invade Hungary or take some other aggressive action, which then mobilized folks against it to allow a containment strategy to work. So I think what the Secretary of State was doing was saying, think about this in the big picture. I think also, to make a second point, because your point is certainly right, that the domestic politics of this is very important in the U.S. as it is in Iran. I think the fundamental and sad part about the Iranian story for us to recognize is that what's going on in Iran today is not about us.
politically.
It's not about us. Mm-hmm. This is 95% driven by a political struggle for power within the regime. And in the American context, I would say the domestic politics is not the 90% of the story. That is, the Secretary of State's not talking domestic politics. She's talking international strategy. Mm-hmm. But she's taking account of the extent to which the U.S. options domestically have been tarnished by the brutal behavior of the Iranian regime in the reaction to the election and the impact of that that's had in the Israelis.
But essentially, what Americans have heard first from George W. Bush and then essentially from Obama up until, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to my ear, up until last week in Thailand was, no way, no how is Iran ever going to have nuclear weapons, period. We will not permit that. Do you see this as a change in that, or is it just a more nuanced communication, a more honest? Well, that would be a change if it's more honest.
I'd say it's an extraordinarily good question, that because the first line is no way, no how. That's been the Bush administration line. That's the Obama administration lines. That's the objective. But I think actually, if you listen to the quote that you did from the Sunday show, mm-hmm. Hillary's statement that says, we're hoping for the best, but of course we have to have a plan B and plan for the worst, suggests a realism about the fact that the strategy available may not succeed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking this hour, could we cope with a nuclear Iran? As Hillary Clinton talks defense umbrella and Israel talks attack options. Barry Posen is with us. He is director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. Graham Allison is here, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, both steeped in these issues. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. A very busy week for American officials in Israel. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has just been there. The Special Envoy George Mitchell in the region this week. The Dennis Ross envoy to the Gulf States, to Israel, headed to Israel. National Security Advisor to President Obama James Jones, all headed into Israel in this week after Hillary Clinton raised the notion of a defense umbrella. We're going to hear directly from Israel in a few minutes. But Barry Posen, first to you in this question of the real possibility of a defense umbrella. And first, if you could clarify, I mean, as you understand what that might or could mean, does that mean old-fashioned nuclear deterrence, Iran? I mean, you mentioned missile shield, but the old-fashioned kind was you do anything with a nuclear weapon and we hit you back with a nuclear weapon, devastating nuclear attack from the United States. Is that what it suggests?
Well, Graham mentioned the defensive shield. And given the nature of nuclear weapons, a defensive shield is never enough because all it takes is a small number mm-hmm. of nuclear warheads to penetrate a defense that could cause a catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why you invariably end up relying on deterrence. One of America's objectives, and I think one of the rest of the world's objectives in this region, if Iran gets a near nuclear capability, mm-hmm. will also be discouraging others from doing the same. So to discourage others from doing the same, you almost surely will have to offer something that looks like these words are all sort of euphemistic, mm-hmm. but something that looks like a guarantee that basically says to the Iranians, the United States, and I actually would prefer it to be a bigger thing. I would prefer it to be a U.S., European, the rest of the world basically says that Iranian nuclear attacks on others are going to be viewed as attacks on the rest of us because we just can't live in a world where people pull nuclear weapons on others and use them, right? So you, the Iranians, should be considering very carefully any use of nuclear weapons that you imagine because there's a very, very good chance there's going to be a nuclear retaliation.
What does that mean? I mean, in the old Soviet days, it was very clearly spelled out. Would we be saying here, Iranian nuclear anything touches Israel or Dubai or the UAE Tehran is, atomized?
Look, it depends on the facts of the case, right? In other words, at this point, and as I think it's much more likely that the world will be living with a near nuclear capability in Iran than a nuclear. In other words, an active enrichment program nominally attached to a power industry, but that nevertheless could be diverted.
Yeah, but it's the threat. You have to take the weapon into account as the threat.
Yeah, ultimately, if there's a weapon, yes. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, if the weapon is used. And mm-hmm. the only thing that really counts in these situations is a threat to retaliate. And I think in the end, you're going to be driven to make those kinds of threats if you're going to try and make this containment policy work. And if you don't want to make those kinds of threats, then you probably shouldn't launch this kind of policy.
Is that what you understand by a defense umbrella, Graham Allison? nuclear
retaliation. By the way, she didn't
guarantee?
Use the word. By the way, you should be careful.
She said defense umbrella.
Yes, she didn't use the term nuclear.
That's
why
I'm
asking. Understands. She doesn't want. She and the Obama administration doesn't want to have this conversation yet, and they don't have to have this conversation yet.
But right? She raised it. Defense umbrella, and Americans with our history can't help but kind of hear nuclear umbrella.
Well, and actually, if you go to the end of the sentence, she said defense umbrella against an Iran that had acquired nuclear weapons.
And of course, we have an umbrella over Japan and over South Korea. We know this concept.
I think you're right to remember what the umbrella concept means. So in the case today, let's take North Korea. We go to Japan and South Korea and say we have defense alliances according to which if you were attacked by North Korea, we would respond with an overwhelming response. And then we have conversations about what precisely that would mean, including nukes for nukes. Okay. So I would say that what's in prospect is the notion that if an Iran had nuclear weapons and if Iran were to use nuclear weapons, if against Israel, there's no question Israel would itself have an overwhelming response, but you might imagine an alliance arrangement that would look rather like the U.S.-Japanese defense treaty. Indeed, that subject's been discussed. In the case of the other states,
Turkey, Saudi Arabia,
and further, one could imagine, as Barry suggests, some version of either a U.S. unilateral or even a multilateral arrangement. Now,
we'll protect you with our nuclear weapons, so you don't have to develop your own.
Right. That would be the
idea.
What the treaty would say. The question is, how reassuring would this be to the specific states that might want to do something for themselves? For Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and perhaps for Turkey, I think there's a big, big question mark. So I would say in the Saudi case, it seems highly unlikely, as I watch their society, that we would be successful over any sustained period of time.
Meaning they wouldn't trust that we would be standing by with the guaranteed retaliation.
They believe we are very uncertain allies, that we from time to time have governments that want to change other governments, that we care about making arrangements inside other societies. So I would say for the Saudis, a big question mark. For the Egyptians, who regard themselves as the leader of the Arab countries, the notion that there's a nuclear bomb and not a Sunni bomb, hard for them to believe. Now, again, they've got a long way to go. But I'd say the Saudis would most likely be buyers, not builders, buyers.
Buy a bomb.
And Pakistan is a thick relationship in which I'm sure I'd be surprised if there hadn't been some conversations.
With A.Q. Khan already somewhere back there.
And for the Egyptians, they've got a long way to go for building. For the Turks, a long way to go for building. So I think if, God forbid, Iran is successful in getting a nuclear weapon, the U.S. will make a maximum effort to reassure other states in order to prevent the knock-on effect, because I think that's the biggest danger in the dynamic.
Barry Posen is on the record a couple of years back saying we can live with a nuclear Iran. The deterrence and the interests of the countries you mentioned could lead to an acceptable situation here. What about you? What we've been told as Americans in the past is this is simply not acceptable, and we won't, and we will intervene to make sure we never have to live with that. Could we, in fact, live with a nuclear Iran?
Well, Barry and I have had this discussion before. I think that if we're forced to live in a world with an Iranian nuclear bomb, we'll be living in a much more dangerous world in which I think the likelihood of nuclear wars in the region go up significantly and the likelihood that nuclear weapons come loose. So I believe a maximum effort should be made to prevent Iran crossing the gold line and getting nuclear weapons, and stopping them short of nuclear weapons, even at near nuclear status, as Barry mentioned, is a hugely better arrangement than an Iran that has a nuclear bomb. Because I think if Iran gets a nuclear bomb, it seems to me within the decade that follows, Saudi and Egypt and maybe Turkey will be moving. I think you put nuclear weapons and a race to acquire nuclear weapons into a region as volatile as that, I believe the Israelis will act, or I believe there'll be accidents. So I think this is a nightmare scenario, an Iranian nuclear bomb for me.
We're going to go to Israel in just a minute. Let me get a couple calls, and Barry, I want you on this point. Eric in Northampton, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
I'm worried about the thought that these people from MIT and Harvard are very rational, and they're attributing to the Iranians the same rationale that they have. And that's just been the kiss of death for our foreign policy, thinking that everybody is thinking like we are. the fact that maybe the whole world will intimidate them and not sell them Quaker Oats or whatever might will just galvanize them and make them stronger. And they don't point this out. I'm guessing that not many of these people are experts about these cultures, but they're experts about other things.
Eric, let us pick it up. Barry Posen, here's the notion that the Iranian leaders are ideologues. You can't, you know, they're not going to sit around rationally talking about this. You can't reason with these people sort of notion. What do you say to that? And how does it go to the issue of whether or not we can live with, could, might, a nuclear-armed Iran?
The issue is whether the Iranians are, the current Iranian leadership likes being the leadership of Iran, values the lives of their own countrymen, are sensitive to costs, right? It's not whether they think about everything the way we think about things. Nuclear weapons are in many ways rather simple and simplifying kind of things. To be a nuclear weapon state is to be a nuclear target. To use nuclear weapons is to be a nuclear target. It doesn't take very long. It doesn't take very many discussions with your own physicists or your own soldiers who design and use these weapons to tell you what it means to be in a nuclear war with others.
But in Eric's call, is the question, do they really care?
Yes, they do care. We have ample evidence to care. I mean, anybody who's, almost everybody who studies the Iranians in terms of their strategic behavior will tell you they do behave strategically. They are sensitive to cost. Yes, they want to expand their power. Yes, they want to expand their influence, but they are not interested in self-immolation. If the Iranians were interested in self-immolation, they've had many, many opportunities, starting with the Iraq-Iran war, right, to achieve that, and they don't. Yes, they use violence. Yes, they're willing to pay pay price, military, political, and economic price. But there's no evidence that these people are courting suicide. Sometimes in their language and rhetoric, they like to make it sound like they did, but Chairman Mao used to do the same thing. When you're weak, you want to sort of let others think that somehow you're not impressed by their power. But the Iranians are very good at gauging power, and everyone should sort of remember what Iran is. Iran is a country whose total gross domestic product is roughly half of the United States defense budget. This is not a superpower, and people should get the idea out of their heads that you're dealing with a superpower.
But
it's
nuclear
not.
Weapons are a kind
nuclear
of equalizer.
Weapons don't,
are they?
Nuclear weapons don't make them a superpower. The United States has a gigantic strategic nuclear force. We're talking about an immense struggle for this country to put together the fissionable material for a few handfuls of nuclear weapons. This is one of the things the Iranians need to know. The problem is not just getting the first fission weapon. The problem is not just getting the first rocket. The problem is being in a competition with others who may not want you to have a secure second strike capability, who may not want
Certainly
you to have
wouldn't.
A secure retaliatory capability, and are going to be looking to find ways to best you. So you're opening the door, and this is what I think Mrs. Clinton was trying to say, you're opening the door to an unbelievable competition with some of the richest and most capable military states
and
in the
world. And you think they will think about that.
I think they will certainly think before they use a nuclear weapon on somebody.
I want to go to the Israeli perspective here. There was a strong pushback when the defense umbrella phrase came from the Secretary of State in Thailand last week. Lots of Americans in Israel this week. First, let's hear from U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates. This was at a press conference in Jerusalem yesterday, expressing concern about Iran acquiring nuclear weapons.
A nuclear-armed Iran would be profoundly destabilizing to the entire region and a threat to certainly to Israel and a threat to the United States and other states as well.
And here in Jerusalem, Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak saying his country, Israel, won't limit its options when it comes to dealing with Iran's nuclear program.
Israel remains in its basic position that no options should be removed from the table in spite of the fact that at this stage a priority should be given still to diplomacy and probably sanctions.
No options removed from the table, says the Israeli defense minister. Joining us right now from Tel Aviv is Ephraim Sneh, former Labor Party member of the Israeli Knesset. Left the party in 2008 to form the Yisrael Hazaka Strong Israel Party. Former deputy defense minister of Israel, a couple of sessions there, most recently 2006 to 2007, retired brigadier general in the Israeli Defense Forces. Ephraim Sneh, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
What's your response to the U.S. Secretary of State raising this notion of a defense umbrella for the Middle East, presumably including Israel? Does that give you comfort?
The historic lessons that we Israelis and Jews should remember is that we cannot rely on anybody else's umbrella. We have to rely on ourselves, and to defend ourselves, we shouldn't ask anyone, even our best allies, to fight for us or to defend us. We should rely on ourselves. A small nation which relies on others is doomed. And I hope, I believe, we have enough indigenous capabilities to defend ourselves. We should develop them. I'm not saying that they are sufficient, but I believe that they can be quickly built.
Ephraim Sneh, you say you have enough capacity, Israel does, to defend itself. Does it have enough capacity to attack Iran, to take out Iran's nuclear program if the United States is not on board with that kind of action?
As one who served 2 decades in Israeli Defense Forces and was several times member of our inner defense cabinet, I can tell you that there is no operational problem that we cannot find a solution to. By the way, I don't advocate military action against Iran, mm-hmm. but we can't abandon this option, because if we are with our back to the wall, if we see that the Iranian nuclear bomb is very, very soon will be acquired by the regime in Tehran, and nobody does something tangible, real, to stop it, we will have no choice. Israel, I heard very frequently in your talk, if we can live with, you may live with Iranian bomb. We can't. We can't, because we are vulnerable. We are a small country. Most, not all, but most of our economic and intellectual assets are concentrated in a narrow strip of 10 miles on 50 miles, very vulnerable to weapon of mass destruction. We cannot afford a first strike. And our problem is not the second strike. Our problem is how to prevent the first one. And I advocate increasing our long-range capacities. I advocate that the United States will help us in some of the defensive measures that we develop, like the Arrow anti-ballistic missile defense system and others, and it is done. It is done, by the way. But we cannot live with the implication of nuclear Iran while the current regime is there is inconceivable for us, because the implications of nuclear Iran on the life in Israel, the meaning of living under the shadow, under the cloud of Iranian bomb, will change the life in Israel in a way that will ruin all our dreams.
Ephraim Sneh, we just have 30 seconds before we have to take a break here. In a word, can you imagine any situation in which Israel would rely on deterrence, its own or others, to protect it from Iranian nuclear weapons?
You can't deter a regime which has the characteristics of the current regime in Tehran. The issue of deterrence comes from the Cold War, when there were in Washington and in Moscow two rational, responsible governments, though totally different in their philosophies.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking this hour, could we cope with a nuclear Iran? As Hillary Clinton talks defense umbrella and Israel talks attack options, with us from Tel Aviv is Ephraim Sneh, former deputy defense minister of Israel. With me in the studio from MIT, Barry Posen, author of Inadvertent Escalation, and from Harvard, Graham Allison, author of Nuclear Terrorism. Let's get a call right here from Toronto, Canada. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see?
Okay, Tom, I have traveled to Iran and to the other parts of the world, and I'm really confused that IAEA has confirmed that Iran is not developing the nuclear weapons. absolutely there is no evidence at all. Russia does not believe, China do not, China, Africa, Latin America, nobody buys our story. And second, Tom, you are such a wonderful man with such wonderful programs. When are we going to have a program on 300 nuclear weapons of Israel? This is the greatest threat. This is the greatest threat. Why are we not talking about that?
Robert, let us pick them both up. At this point, you're quite right. There's no secret. Israel's nuclear armed and with plenty of those weapons. But let me pick up your question on the Iranians' program itself. Graham Allison, let me bring this one to you. Robert, you know, not persuaded that, in fact, there is a concerted campaign toward nuclear weapons in Iran. We take it as a kind of given. Many of our leaders, right up to our head of state, have done the same over time. But what do you say?
Well, Robert's on a good but complicated issue. I'd say, Robert, the national intelligence estimate, which is the best judgment of the American intelligence community, concludes that Iran has not made a final decision about acquiring nuclear weapons, that that's a political decision beyond the current position. This is the December 2007 estimate that so far hasn't been updated. So it concludes that Iran will have a window between 2010 and 2015 in which it will have put itself in a position to make such a decision, and that if it were to make such a decision, the period between that decision and making a nuclear bomb, given that they've built the infrastructure for a nuclear weapons program, will be brief.
None of that makes the current work nuclear program work irrelevant to the possibility of a nuclear weapon.
It could lean toward that, but there's a final decision.
And the
focus of American policy and of international policy, so this is, Robert is not correct about this. If you look at the UN Security Council resolutions, there have been three resolutions, two of them unanimous, the other one overwhelming, demanding that Iran cease enrichment, suspend enrichment of activity, and engage in negotiations because the current Iranian program, it will leave them, in effect, with a short step between where they are and when they get a nuclear bomb. Today, Iran has 5,000 centrifuges spinning. It's enriched more than 2,500 pounds of low-enriched uranium. Mm. That's more than enough low-enriched uranium with further reprocessing for their first nuclear bomb. So Iran is already... I wrote a provocative piece, a provocatively titled piece. Mm. Iran has already lost its nuclear virginity in that respect. That is, Iran now knows how to enrich uranium and has the indigenous capability to enrich uranium. And if you can enrich uranium, the step between that and a bomb is a very short step. So the complication for the Israelis and for the Americans at this stage is that Iran has already gotten so far down the track that if we were to bomb them today, or if Israel were to bomb them today, we can't eliminate that knowledge of the capability and the indigenous inside Iran structure for building centrifuges and operating centrifuges. And I think that's the nub of our problem.
Robert raises Israel's nuclear arsenal. Barry Posen, we've got Ephraim Sneh with us in Tel Aviv, but let's turn to Israel. You heard Ephraim Sneh, former Deputy Defense Minister of Israel, say, number one, Israel, whatever you like, the United States, Israel cannot depend on deterrence. And number two, Israel itself has the capacity to, as I understood him, go militarily at Iran's nuclear capacity if it might choose to.
Well, if Israelis don't believe in deterrence, we have the odd problem of trying to explain why they have several hundred nuclear weapons and a very sophisticated set of delivery systems, right? So somebody somewhere along the way in Israel's past decided that nuclear weapons must be good for something and may even have envisioned this day when Israel might have to live in a world of nuclear adversaries. Two, given the magnitude of the Israeli program, and it's not large compared to some of the superpowers, but for a small power program, it's quite a lot of nuclear weapons are enormously destructive items. The Israelis are in a position under most circumstances that one can imagine to wreck Iran or any number of other countries as functioning societies.
But Mr. Sneh says the second strike is not an option. First strike could be too destructive to Israel.
This is always true. Any nuclear situation where you depend on deterrence doesn't give you the ability to limit damage to yourself. What it gives you the ability to do is to threaten the other side with unacceptable damage under any and all circumstances, so that the thought, the idea of launching this first strike becomes self-evidently nutty, right? Insane, self-destructive, beyond words, right? And one only needs to spend a few minutes looking at the Iranian economy and looking at the Israeli systems to realize just how much damage the Israelis can do to Iran. So, General Snez is totally right to say that, you know, Israel is very vulnerable to a nuclear strike by a handful of weapons. But most countries who are in nuclear competitions are highly vulnerable because nuclear weapons are actually kind of cheap and enormously destructive and easy to deliver and easy to package, and that's the world. So Iran can't in any circumstances tell itself a story where it does well in this exchange. In fact, the only thing that comes from this terrible, terrible event that we're talking about and that we hope never happens, right, is the mutual assured destruction of both sides. That's the likely outcome. Right, and it's on that basis that we essentially ran, managed, and won the superpower competition with Russia.
But if
it's on this basis, and it's on this basis that the Israelis and we, well, will deal with an Iranian nuclear program if it comes to fruition.
But Ephraim Snez says no, they won't because they don't trust in deterrence. They're not going down that road. I'll turn to him in just a moment.
What he says is that his country would prefer not to live that way. Now we have to ask
and
ourselves
has the capacity to prevent that reality.
General Snez, there's a little bit of ambiguity what he's saying here. We've done the analysis at our group. Yes, the Israeli Air Force can do a very interesting attack on the Iraqi programs that we know about, right? And that attack will set the Iraqis back some way.
In spite of the fact that they're buried there in urban population centers.
But the Israelis can't deal with the problem that Graham just laid out, the fact that the Iranians have figured out how to build the centrifuges. I'm not sure the Israelis even know where the centrifuges are built. I'm not sure we know where all the centrifuges are built. We can't deal with all the scientists and engineers who have figured this out. So at best, what the Israelis can do through a very interesting attack that's a marvel for a country of its size, is take out the most obvious elements of this Iranian enrichment program that Graham is talking about. And this will certainly set the Iranians back some number of years. But it can't deny the Iranians this capability. It can't end the conflict with Iran. It can't prevent some future in which Iran is nuclear. And it's not even clear that an American preventive attack, which would be much larger and much more devastating, can achieve this. But it's certainly most unlikely that the Israelis can. So what the Israelis can do is buy themselves a couple more years of essentially being the military, you know, the unchallenged military hegemon of this part of the world, right? At the cost of making a lot of Iranians really angry, making a lot of other people really angry, complicating our diplomacy enormously, right? Those are some of the benefits of the non-benefits of an Israeli preventive attack. So yeah, I see why the Israelis would prefer to have a few more years of peace, but it happens to not be in the United States' interest for Israel to make this attack. And if Israel makes this attack, it will be making it with American weapons and American technology, and I think we have something to say about this, right? The idea that we don't have any influence on this, I think, is fatuous. We have something to say about it.
Let us come back to exactly that point, but first, Ephraim Snez, what do you make of this analysis, that at best Israel could buy a couple of years' security at tremendous cost?
Let me comment on the issue of the Israeli deterrence. The Israeli deterrence, which was just mentioned, was built against the conventional superiority of the Arab countries vis-à-vis Israel. It was not a deterrence vis-à-vis the nuclear power of an Arab or Muslim state. That's what the equation is going to be changed, and the deterrence that worked in 73 and maybe later now is in total doubt.
Could you not adapt your deterrence capacity?
There is no symmetry between Israel and Iran about vulnerability, the decision-making mechanism, and the responsibility of the regime. Now, we are talking about to attack, not to attack. Before that, and I fully agree that that military attack has a very, very grave repercussions. No doubt about that. That's why I say this is, for us, the Israelis, is the really very last resort. But the sanctions. Nothing is said and done, really, about sanctions. This regime, especially now, in the current oil prices, is more vulnerable to economic sanctions. Instead of discussing the military option, and instead of wasting time on the diplomatic option, which I believe is fruitless, let's use the time for what the Secretary Clinton calls crippling sanctions on Iran. The discussion today is not the discussion that we could have 2-3 months ago. Something happened in Iran in mm-hmm. June, and it exposed a situation where most of the people is against the regime. Now, this is a time to drive a wider wedge between the people and the regime. It can be done through sanctions, which would make it impossible for the regime to govern. The problem is not the nuclear project. The problem is there is here a regime driven by ideology of hatred to everything that Boston and Tel Aviv have in common. Everything. It was ambition to become a superpower, not in American / Soviet standards, but a superpower in the sense of leverages on the world. And if they will have nuclear ballistic missile with a range of thousands of miles, and if they can block the Strait of Hormuz, where 40% of the oil consumption of the West is passing through, for them, that's enough. They are looking for leverages, not for economic power.
Let me take a call here, if I may, from Warwick, Rhode Island, and Vladimir. Vladimir, you're on the air with our guests.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Thank you for letting me in the air.
Yes.
To me, Clinton's speech in Thailand is a clear indication of change in American policy toward nuclear Iranian ambition. And Iran will understand the same, probably. Now about protective umbrella. Would country in the region accept nuclear Iran? It will trigger nuclear arms race, because nobody would like to rely on foreign power to protect them or retaliate with a kind. Everybody prefers to be able to protect itself. So it's probably change of policy and not very good change.
And you're predicting out of it a nuclear arms race in the region. Graham Allison, our the clock ticks down mercilessly, and there's so much on the table. It's rich. A couple of things let's put out there. Ephraim Schnee says diplomatic effort, which has been a primary point of emphasis by the Obama administration, no use. Crippling sanctions, the time is right now and good for it. Barry Posen says if it's going to go beyond that, if it's going to go anywhere near some military action here, what about American interests? And they may not be the same as Israel's, and the United States ought to have something quite significant to say about that. Jump in where you will, Graham.
Well, on Vladimir's point, I would say yes. The greatest danger of an Iranian nuclear bomb, in my view, is the cascade effect it'll have in the region as other states acquire nuclear weapons. And I mentioned I worry first about Saudi, second about Egypt, third about Turkey. I believe if you play out that hand of a multi-nation arms race with Israel in the middle and all the other volatility of the region, the likelihood of a nuclear war is quite large. And
Barry Posen says it doesn't have to happen.
Some of the war's coming loose. I would say on the crippling sanctions, I think the sanctions that we've seen, given the processes that we have, are more or less like the sanctions we're likely to see. I think the
administration, in other words, not crippling.
And I think the U.S. hasn't even been prepared to advocate what would be crippling sanctions, namely if you were to try to have an embargo of gasoline shipments to Iran and maybe of Iranian oil shipments to the world. But that in itself, you wouldn't get a U.N. Security Council resolution for it. And if you didn't, it would be an act of war.
Our time comes down to a minute then. If these are the case, then it seems to put the possibly the military option back out there. Are the U.S. and Israel on a collision course here or something else? It's hard to tell in the language now.
I'd say that that's the $64 question, and I don't think either the Israelis or the American governments know for sure where this is going to come out, but it'll play out over the next year.
Barry Posen, what's your outlook?
Well, I think that there's certainly going to be a discussion. It's not clear to me that the Obama administration has settled itself on whether or not containment and deterrence dominates preventive war as a solution here. If they do decide that it dominates preventive war, then yes, there will be a very interesting negotiation between the Israelis and the Americans, because I don't if we decide that preventive war is not in our interest for us to launch, then it can't be in our interest for Israel to launch the same preventive war, which would be less effective and for which we would be blamed in any case. So I think if the Obama administration does turn towards containment and deterrence as its preferred option, which I think they're doing, right, then I think we are going to have a very intense discussion with the Israelis.
Fascinating discussion right here. The clock goes, the time goes. Ephraim Sneh in Tel Aviv, former Deputy Defense Minister of Israel. Thank you very much for your perspective this hour, General Sneh.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Graham Allison with Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. Thank you very much for joining
us,
Graham. And Barry Posen with MIT's Security Studies Program. Always great to have you. Thanks for
Good
being here, Barry.
Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.